Hey, there's a new show here at Earwolf from the people at Cracked, which is where I work. It's called Cracked Gets Personal. They interview real sources and get answers to questions most people are too afraid to ask, like, is my garbage man keeping tabs on me? Or what's it like to have killed someone? And what does it really feel like to be on heroin? Is it all Jared Leto-y, or does it get a little darker than that? Hosts Brandon Johnson and Robert Evans, who's a really interesting man to work with, combine compassion with comedy to get you those answers and more from real people with very unreal lives. It's a really interesting show. For the past couple of years, Robert Evans has been developing the personal experience section of the website, which is just him and a couple of other people under his tutelage, I guess, just going out and talking to people about their lives, about anything. It's everyone from, like you mentioned, garbage people to doctors, recovering drug addicts, people that have been just through crazy ordeals or just things that you would think would be mundane, but are just like it just this incredible other side of life that you, I know somebody like me would like to have just have never even realized was there. It's a really, really interesting show. Robert and Brandon come at it with a lot of compassion, and it's definitely worth a listen. So subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Game of Thrones fans, take a deep dive into your favorite epic fantasy world with audio from the largest ever convention for GOT fans. Stitcher Premium now has 16 sessions from Con of Thrones, where you can listen to interviews with talent from the show and expert discussions touching on topics like race, gender, and possible spinoffs. It is a must-listen for all Game of Thrones fans. Go to stitcherpremium.com/Con of Thrones and use promo code CRACKED at checkout to get your free month.
Welcome back to the Cracked Movie Club. I'm Abe Epperson.
I'm Tom Ryman.
And we're the self-proclaimed cracked film experts, I guess. We're here to point out some things that you may or may not know about
what
your
do you
favorite
mean, wait
classics.
A minute. What do you mean, you guess?
I don't know.
You're a master.
I'm humble.
Both of you.
We're trying to be humble here.
Sorry, I derailed
it. Don't come at us with our non-humbleness.
Don't cut my intro, bro.
We are the humblest motherfuckers here. Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we're going to make some jokes, too, I guess.
Yeah. We're going to make you experts along the way.
Yeah, so for the next hour or so, we're going to be talking about 2014's Interstellar, directed by Christie Nolan.
Christie Knowles.
That's my new pet name. Along with us is our returning guest, and I'm going to audition this as your new nickname, the real Slim Schmitty. So please stand up. Alex Schmidt returning, who is the Cracks head of podcasting, a writer and performer for the site. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, and especially talking about this movie.
I know.
Interestingly.
Oh my God, I love this movie.
Abe was adamant about having Alex be the guest for this episode.
Because he said the magic words, which was, I was like, Interstellar? And he said, I love that movie.
Yeah.
And then I was like, you're the guest, because there's not many of us here at Cracked. A lot of people like it. A lot of people have some, you know, when you work in a comedian atmosphere, I think that there's a lot of service into like, well, let's pick it apart. And
someone
starts off with a, I love this movie, that they really mean it here.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely true. And I think something about this movie that triggers a more cynical response in people is that it attempts to be earnest and genuine with its emotions. And I feel like this generation of comedians and commentators, we don't know how to react to that.
Yeah, a little. Or at least just in this job. I don't know if it's our generation or this job, but you're probably right
about
that.
Might be this job, yeah. But anyways.
Yeah, in any case, he's here. So Alex, before we jump
he's
in this,
here.
When was the first time you watched this movie? You watched it in theaters?
I saw this the opening weekend at Grauman's Chinese Theater because I live in LA and I do LA things.
Hey.
And I rewatched it for this episode, and I think it's the sixth time I've seen it. It's one of my favorite movies, just period. It's my favorite Christopher Nolan movie.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And I think me and Abe and maybe one other person are
Cody.
The only people in the building who love it.
Yeah, Cody
Everybody
Johnstone.
Else is neutral or not into it.
Before we begin, Alex, can you give a short synopsis of the film?
Yes. The whole planet is dust bowling, and NASA does a secret operation to save humanity by sending it into the stars. But it's also really an art piece about love. And it's fantastic.
On point.
Done it.
Oh my God.
That's it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We can go home. I'm
short,
taking these headphones off.
Sweet. I love it. On this show, we like to take some time to do our own reductive and frankly awful summaries. Join us.
Hilarious.
Okay. Okay.
Awfully hilarious.
We are hilarious. That's true. Join us for our segment, Alex, on Terrible Log Lines.
A man mows down thousands of stalks of precious corn to catch a toy airplane that is never mentioned again.
That's true. Troubled child thinks her spooky bookcase is her dad.
Science learns that statistically, 33% of planets contain a Matt Damon.
That's one third.
The New York Yankees prove they are rich enough to survive the apocalypse.
An old liar convinces astronauts to kill themselves.
Mm.
Guy outlives daughter.
That dancing bag asshole from American Beauty drowns in space.
NASA is the most funded government agency in this wacky, unrealistic post-apocalypse film.
Loser humans tolerated by two cool robots.
A boy grows up to be Casey Affleck and completely loses his will to live.
No.
He's like, oh no, I'm Casey Affleck.
This one, I hope people know the reference. Humanity J.K. Livens. which is a Matthew McConaughey thing. He says, right. J.K. Livin', it's a catchphrase. You get it.
It's, isn't it a...
It means just keep living.
Just keep living. But it also, isn't it a charity? Some kind?
Yeah, it's also a charity. And I respect their work very much. But I want to do a bit about it.
Yeah, jokes, everybody.
You're ruining my joke.
Well, that ends that segment, I guess, right?
We'll see. Yeah. This is a movie.
Well, I guess that's done.
Because also I talked a bit at the top about how much I love it, and many other people don't. It is a movie where I can see how people wouldn't like it, but especially because as you pull out individual moments from it, a lot of the individual moments are like, what? Like,
yeah, you don't necessarily scan it.
Why are people playing four-dimensional baseball, and why is a robot iPhone carrying a lady on a wave planet? And yeah, there's a lot going on.
You're right. This is a new segment that I just created last night because I wanted... Because of comments.
You've gone mad with power.
I want to do a few redactions. I said last episode, John Q in the Mementos episode.
It's John G. Yeah.
I'm just an idiot. And geez, we get it, commenters. As Tom said, a Mobius strip, technically, yes, it has two surfaces, even if it's on one plane. We get it. Because you said one surface.
I said it has one surface,
Hang on. You guys got enraged comments about how Mobius strips work?
We are continuing to get comments about how World War II submarines work.
Man.
Yeah. And the last one is Wally Pfister worked on Memento Inception, but Dunkirk wasn't his first time not shooting.
Right, it was this movie,
It was this movie, which we're about to talk to.
He was making his first film, which was freaking Transcendence.
Transcendence with Johnny Depp.
Which is a movie that came out maybe 20 years too late.
Yeah.
Where
he becomes like a singularity.
What a bummer.
I just wanted to Pfister.
The audience are geniuses, by the way.
Yeah, they are.
They're worried about Mobius strips and World War II submarines.
They're so fast.
Good job.
Yeah.
You guys are great.
It's overwhelming. I can barely wake up in the morning and these people are geniuses.
All right.
Now that you know the plot, let's dive into the making of the movie from a pre-production to post-production standpoint in a segment we call Expensive Pretending.
Yeah.
Tom, let's tell us about the scripting of this.
Okay, well, the script was originally a treatment written by Kip Thorne and Linda Obst, who were... Kip Thorne is a theoretical physicist, I believe, who was working on the film Contact with Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey. In 97, I think it was. But he was a consultant on that film as well because it deals with some of the same things, you know, like astrophysics and such. And Linda Obst is a producer. And they wrote up a treatment based on an idea for another film along those lines, you know, about interstellar travel. And it was, you know, a treatment for what would eventually become Interstellar. And originally it was going to be a Spielberg film.
That's crazy to me. Yeah, in 2006, I think he passed.
It was a little later than that, I believe, because Spielberg actually hired, representing Spielberg, hired Jonathan Nolan to turn this into a screenplay. He wound up passing a little bit later when he moved basically it was because I think the film was in development for like Paramount, and then Spielberg moved DreamWorks from Paramount to a different house, and I'm not sure which one, maybe Warner Brothers, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was Disney. He moved it to Disney.
Yeah, he moved it to Disney.
But yeah, Jonathan Nolan was attached on this for a very long time, and he wrote an original draft that is very different.
Yeah,
if you guys have ever read it.
Yeah, it's bonkers.
It circulated a lot, you know, because the hype for this film, similar to the hype for Inception, which we really didn't talk about in the Inception episode, was that it was a very closely guarded secret what the movie was actually about.
Right.
So the Jonathan Nolan's original draft that he wrote, you know, through the late 2000s was circulated online, and it is bonkers.
Mm. Oh, I remember reading about that on our site. It was something about like a Chinese colony made of robots.
The whole major part of the plot line was that the Chinese had actually begun this initiative to try to save humanity.
Right.
So they had a lot of colonies like spread out throughout the universe, and also like Chinese robots, like long dormant Chinese robots, become like the aggressors in the story. And also there's like aliens. Like an alien ecosystem. It's a completely different film. It's very much an adventure story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not at all what it became, except for maybe, apparently, Christopher Nolan, they did a similar thing that they did with Memento on this, is where Chris Nolan wrote his own screenplay when he became attached to the film. He picked it up after Spielberg dropped it, basically. And he's like, well, there's parts of this that interest me, so what I'll do is I'll write kind of what my own ideas are for this movie, and then we'll kind of merge our scripts. And apparently the first part of the movie with like Coop on the farm with his family, like a lot of that is left over from Jonathan Nolan's original screenplay. And then the second half of the movie is Christopher Nolan's vision, which is way more, more like 2001. Like,
yeah.
It's actually, rewatching it last night, I was surprised about how fast we got into space. It's like act two break, you know?
Yeah. I remember that sequence where he's driving away from his farmhouse and they're just doing the shuttle countdown. We skip over all of the astronaut training stuff, you know, which could have been an additional 30 minutes of them getting ready to go into space. We're just immediately into space. He's like, nope, we're going to skip all that.
Not like this, Murph.
Yeah.
God, that's a heart-wrenching
There
sequence.
Are so many scenes in this movie. There's at least two or three that are just like... it's like so heartbreaking.
Right.
Yeah, because in rewatching it again, I thought, why don't I count how many times I tear up or want to? And this is tearing up having seen the movie a lot.
Right. I know what's coming.
And I had four. Yeah. I had four spots.
I had two definite ones.
I think I said to you like earlier this week, I was like, yeah, I'm going to go do my research on Interstellar tonight because like that's what I have time to do today. It's kind of weird knowing that in like 45 minutes to an hour I'm gonna start crying.
I'm just gonna weep.
Yeah, it really works on me.
And it's amazing to me that people are like, oh, Nolan's such an unemotional filmmaker and he made this,
you know,
it just must have not worked for them at all, because
a few critiques that felt like the emotion got lost in the real heady space stuff, theoretical stuff, and then the sci-fi stuff.
And I buy that. I'm a sucker for that. My other film, apropos of nothing, but like the thing that also works with me where I watch it and I cry all the time, is October Sky. And that's also a space movie, so apparently I'm a spaceman.
And that one was hard because you watch it in school so often, so you have to be like cool around your middle school friends and not let them see.
I'm not crying.
You
know?
Yeah, I'm not crying. I don't care about minors. All right. On that note, though, I want to talk more because there's so much to unpack with the Kip Thorne stuff and the Linda Opes. They're asked by Nolan, like, what a black hole might look like. They couldn't really put it into words because, A, no human's ever really been close to one. And all we have of it is, like, our gravitational lensing in our telescopes, where it's like, well, that's a weird thing, and the stars are, like, you know, drifting and spiraling and doing weird things.
Right, because you can't actually see it.
Light cannot escape. Matter and energy, everything is being sucked into the singularity. So he was like, well, here's the problem. Guys, I got to make a visual representation of this.
Making a movie here.
And we're making a movie here. So, like, tell me about things that might happen. What's cool about it? And the one thing that Nolan really caught on to, they describe that there might be a rainbow because to our eyes, light itself is scattering and being pulled and, you know, like spaghettified as they is a, you know, Sagan term, I believe. And so Nolan, like, really caught on to this description and told his CG department, which, you know, Kip Thorne worked with as well, to develop Gargantua 1. Kip Thorne is also a great book, I just wanted to say as an aside. It's called Black Holes and Time Warps, and it's fantastic for any, like, layman who wants to learn some things about astrophysics. Cool. Like, it really is, you should check it out if you're interested in this kind of thing.
Well, because didn't he also did like a companion book for this movie, right? I haven't read it, despite being such a fan of it.
Yes, he did.
But I hear that's great.
Yeah, he was definitely, of the two, he was the guy who was like working with the visual effects. Like, it was very important to Nolan that he was scientifically like pretty correct. In fact, Dr. Kip Thorne laid down two guidelines to strictly follow for, he was like, if I'm involved in this film, nothing would violate established physical laws in your film. And that all wild speculations would spring from science, not from the creative mind of a screenwriter, which is such a, like, a science is going to win. You know, it's like a very, like, all right, man, we're making movies that are going to make dollars,
like,
okay?
Dude, you're a real bummer.
But Nolan accepted it, and he was just like, you know, as long as you don't get in the way of making the movie, I'll do it. And at one point, Thorne spent 2 weeks trying to talk Nolan out of an idea about a character traveling faster than light before Nolan just gave up. Like, he beat Nolan. He was like, nah, I think you should go faster than light. He's like, it can't be done. And he was just like, ah, I don't know.
But what if?
Yeah. But according to Thorne, the element that has the highest degree of artistic freedom is the clouds of ice on one of the planets that they visit.
It's on man's planet.
Man's planet, yeah. Because that just can't really happen because ice doesn't have the strength to support it and gravity. And
right. Like, I remember having that thought in that scene. It's like, you know, initially, like, oh, that's cool. The clouds are freezing. It's so cold. And it's like, wait, wouldn't they just fall?
Wouldn't they fall? I mean, like, you're not like floating. You got gravity. You're like walking. So
because clouds are just moisture, right?
Yeah. It's air vapor. Or, I mean, water vapor.
It would just fall out of the sky.
Or they it'd would. Be a solid wall or something.
Yeah. He was like, I don't love that one, but I'll let it slide. And it's just like, I love the idea that Nolan's like, okay, you have no power here, really. But I'm thankful for all of your service. As a random aside, I want to say that Kip Thorne and Linda Obst met each other after Carl Sagan set them up on a blind date. Isn't that awesome?
Are they a couple?
I don't know if they still are. I didn't actually do enough research for that, but that was how they originally met.
Oh. And then they worked on the film Contact, which is an adaptation of a Carl Sagan novel.
Correct.
Cool. Also starring Matthew McConaughey, which we already mentioned.
I'd like to think Carl Sagan does all of his matchmaking at launches of gold records. Like he just arranges more of them so there's a thing and he can bring them together, you know? That's his Cupid move.
Anyway. I did this. Yeah. That was Sagan's legacy. Nothing about all the space stuff.
Yeah, so the people he's trying to set up can see each other doing like their best talent or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, see how well that man plays the ukulele? You guys should go on a date.
Carl Sagan, matchmaker.
I always think it's a Tobias Fuque, like, a Cupid I shall play. And then it's just so happening a problem.
On to financing. It took $165 million to make, and it made back $675 million. So that seems like a net of $500 or so.
Not from what I read, though.
Yeah, calculating all its expenses, and this is just something that listeners may be interested to hear. It's estimated that the film made a profit of $47 million, which when you look at, it took $165 to make, and then they made back six. It's because it doesn't work like that in the movie industry.
No, it's not a one-to-one.
Yeah, it's not only that. The $165 is also not really quite the post-production budget, but there's also just an alarming amount of royalties and things to be paid back. So when you hear something like, it made five times as much as it took to make. In filmmaking, typically, what that comes out to be is like, they made like a few million dollars. You know, like it's strangely, they do net weird. And it's, I think it's mainly because of post-production.
It's post-production and marketing costs are huge. Distribution costs are huge. Nolan's salary on this film was insane. He got $20 million up front and then 20% of the gross.
Of that $47.2 million, he got a heavy hand.
Well, I'm sure that was already factored in before they calculated that 47.
The film was 169 minutes long. So if it had cost 165 million to make.
It's almost that works out to a minute, yeah.
Someone did the math. $976,331 per minute.
Worth it.
Worth it.
Worth it.
Agreed.
Yeah. It's great.
That's all I got on finance.
Well, I also like who but I'm glad you guys are talking about Nolan so much this month because I feel like maybe other than Spielberg, who else can get away with an original idea based on relativity and black holes that cost this much to make? You know what I mean?
I know, right?
Like when this movie was on the way, I was probably too in my head about Hollywood business and how it works, but I was thinking like this needs to work because then more people can do this.
Yeah,
otherwise,
yeah.
The guy who gets to do this.
I don't even think Spielberg's been able to do that.
No.
Yeah.
I think we've mentioned before on the podcast that he didn't get a $100 million budget until Minority Report in 2002.
Yeah, which is incredible.
And he hasn't had like Nolan, I think, was able to do this because he had a string of movies that hit like $1 billion.
Right, because he made Batman.
He made the Batman movies, and then Inception was huge. So, yeah, he was in a unique position. And it was also another dual studio thing, I believe, because it split between
Paramount
and
Warner Brothers.
And Legendary Pictures.
Wait, which one? Inception?
Yes. Interstellar.
Interstellar? Oh, okay.
It's Paramount and Legendary, I believe.
Okay, I thought.
And then Inception was Legendary Warner Brothers.
Man, like assembling all the studios
getting two different just so they can afford this movie.
But he's like the person in the entire business who gets to try this.
He has like the winningest track record, I think. Yeah, yeah, he's in a very unique position to do that. Yeah.
You're right. Paramount was North America. Warner Brothers was the international release, so we didn't witness the Warner Brothers tag.
Yeah. Do you think, I don't know if this would have been a good Steven Spielberg movie. He's great. It would have been fine. But like Nolan's approach, I feel like, was very crucial. I think if it was Spielberg, it would have ended up being that thing where it's somebody running away from robots in space.
Rather than the tense
Apollo 13 kind of thing.
Maybe. I feel like Spielberg would have focused much, much more on the family stuff.
Oh,
I agree.
And less on the other stuff,
saving humanity stuff, yeah,
yeah,
or just like in general, like my fate. What's crazy is that there's a whole lot of heart in this movie, but like my takeaway, not in just the like docking sequence and like just like oh that's Hans Zimmer, you nailed it. It's more also of like the I love the conversations between Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey in these. Like, there's a lot of really good like, well, no. We got to do science. You know, you can't like have emotions.
Everybody's good in this movie, I think. And in particular, this is my favorite, I think, in any movie casting of kid and adult playing the same character with Murph.
Oh,
like that kid who's Murph
kills
is incredible.
It.
She's
and
real
then
good.
Somehow matches Jessica Chastain, like emotionally, physically, performance wise, everything. It's great.
I think the kid who plays his son is also good. Is the kid's doing a pretty, I mean, it may not go beyond just doing a Casey Affleck impression, but like if you watch him, he holds himself the same, carries himself the same way as Casey Affleck, and he speaks the same way.
You're right about that.
I hadn't given him any credit.
So the kids are good, yeah.
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 Yeah, that's absolutely right. Who's on the team? Crew-wise.
No Wally Pfister this time.
No Wally Pfister. He was busy.
We talked about that. He was busy making a terrible movie. So it was like Hoyte van something. What was the cinematographer?
Hoytema?
Oh, yeah.
Hoyte van Hoytema? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And I don't know what else he's done, to be honest. But he owned the cinematography. And just like in Inception, he shot anamorphic 35 and then a shit ton of 70mm IMAX.
So much IMAX. And you can see this dude Hoyte. Nolan was sort of wary or doubtful about being able to use IMAX in interior scenes and like close scenes. But this dude, Hoyte, the cinematographer, just handheld shot a lot of the IMAX stuff, which is insane because the IMAX camera is enormous.
Enormous.
It is a big camera.
It's got a huge magazine, which is a term for like the tank that holds all the film. And you can get smaller versions of it, but when it's 70mm, that's twice the size. So imagine a camera that's essentially 150% bigger than a film camera.
Yeah.
And if anyone's seen a photo of that, that's not, you know, that's 35, 40 pounds. So this thing was probably upwise 50 pounds, and he's putting it on his back for, emotional takes. You know,
he must be like a Shaq-sized athlete or something. He must be crazy.
He's like a big Scandinavian man.
Yeah. Yeah, nice.
I believe he's Scandinavian with a name like that.
Yeah,
he's Dutch, right? Something like that.
Maybe.
Hoytema?
Yeah, he had an accent.
I shouldn't just make that up. I don't know why I'm doing that.
Bad Alex. No.
Dutch is probably more accurate. We should look that up.
I'm definitely ignorant, so someone in the comments, tell us, where could we be better?
Dutch Swedish.
Okay, so okay,
you're both right. Yeah, good on both of you.
We covered all our Northern European bases. Good.
Room with a bunch of champions.
Yeah, dude. Nathan Crowley's also back, set designer.
Oh, my God. What good work.
So much of this, a shocking amount of this movie is in camera, meaning that they use CG minimally. Much of the effects are in camera. They built just a crazy number of things that I guess we'll talk about when we get to the
notably, he built three spacecrafts for the film. The Endurance, which was based on the International Space System.
That's the big one.
It's a big one. Circle. It's the one that, yeah, that it literally looks like a clock, which is interesting because the movie's about time. The Ranger, which is how they descend to, you know.
It's like the shuttle, yeah.
It's a shuttle. And then the Lander, which is how they get on planets. So he built these three hunks of steel, and he based it on actual, like, either sci-fi fiction or science fiction, like books and movies, or real life, you know.
Yeah, it all looks like what NASA's going to do next year.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the Endurance, the big one, was a scale model, but they made full size versions of the other two crafts.
They had to, yeah.
Which is insane to me.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Hans
Zimmer does the score in this one, which is really interesting to me because it is unlike any score that he's done to my knowledge, and that's because its primary instrument is an organ.
Yeah, and it's a big fucker too.
Big organ.
Yeah, it's like a whole church that has an organ installed into like the walls. So you can play it. It's like, yeah, it's a four manual Harrison and Harrison organ. And it was a lot of the music was played by the church music director, Roger Sayer. And the organ was like from 1926. It's London Temple Church is where a lot of the recording happened for that. But of course, Hans Zimmer went back and he had choruses. He had a bunch of strings.
There's stuff to it. But
that makes total sense here in that.
Yeah, the fact that it's church music basically is very significant.
Right. Yeah. And that's a lot of the key pieces of like the emotional sequences that we all remember where like the music takes the forefront, the organ plays a big role. I thought the most interesting thing that when I was researching this is about Nolan and Zimmer's collaboration at this point, because they've done a bunch of films, is hilarious to me. In fact, Nolan says about his collaboration with Zimmer, quote, "I'm going to give you an envelope with a letter in it. One page. It's going to tell you the fable at the center of the story. You work for one day, then play me what you have written," which just feels like I think that Nolan and Zimmer think that they're in this long-standing D&D campaign.
Yeah.
It's like he gave him a series of riddles.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah. It sounds like he said that and then turned into a cloud of bats.
Right. Yeah. And then Zimmer was quoted in his replying, like, "This story, this fable, these bits of dialogue he wrote for me were full of personal information that he had about myself and my children." I know I'm saying it with a certain inflection, but it's just hilarious.
So
that,
he
like,
sent him a serial killer's letter.
Right. Make music.
And I want you to make music based on this.
Yeah. All right. I don't know. Zimmer's not.
Well, Zimmer is German.
Zimmer is very German. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's pretty normal.
I received the letter, and I used it to build an organ.
It turned out that the letter was all about my family and things that I had done in my past, which was alarming, but very useful.
The last thing I want to add about Zimmer's score is that most of it is recorded at a tempo of a beat per second, BPM 60. Precisely matching the passage of time. So it's like, I love it when composers...
Alex is just shaking his head.
Yeah.
Man.
I love it
Mind's
when,
blown.
I love it when there's like a, I don't have to do anything. I can do whatever I want. Oh, you know what? It's about time. So I'm going to like make this really weird limitation on myself for the film just because I'm an artist.
It makes sense though. If you're making a movie about time, music, you can do a lot of deliberate things to play with time signatures.
Yeah, but
it's time based.
But literally zero people in the theater were like took a stopwatch and
right.
were like, "Oh my god, nailed it."
No, he did that. He did that because like this is for Hans.
This is for Hans. Yeah. Only for Hans.
This is for Hans. He's sitting there in the back theater, "Yes."
Yes.
It's very deliberate the things that I did for this movie score. Okay, so let's talk about the production. Where we get some cool stuff. Look of the world, like Earth, was heavily inspired by Ken Burns' Dust Bowl documentary.
It's amazing if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
It is my favorite Ken Burns documentary, and I really like Ken Burns documentaries.
Came out in 2012, right?
Yeah. I watched it as it came out on PBS. It's only two chunks. It's a lot shorter than the Civil War baseball
right.
or something like that.
In fact, footage from that film is used in Interstellar as the interviews with like the older elderly
folks.
Yeah,
those testimonials.
Yeah.
Those are people talking about the Dust Bowl.
They bookend the film, and there's also a segment where he, like, when he's at Cooper Station, Coop walks by, you know, because it's like a museum. Those are actual folks who went through the 1920s Dust Bowl.
And as a viewer, I wished I knew a little less about movies, because the first person they had doing a testimonial is Ellen Burstyn.
Yeah,
right.
In the modern day, doing an acting thing. And I'm not like trying to brag about knowing movies, but I was like, oh yeah, Ellen Burstyn, that's interesting. Rather than being just like, oh, this is a person, which is I think the effect they wanted is, oh, this is just a person. Because then after that, they use a bunch of clips from Ken Burns the Dust Bowl
right.
of
right.
actual people talking about their actual experience with it.
Yeah, it's super effective though.
Yeah, it's real effective.
Because I'm
and
like,
that's my first cry spot. It's really hard. I'm very emotional about that documentary.
That's literally the first shot of the film.
Yeah, I know.
And all weepy about the Dust Bowl.
Ellen. Oh, God.
Grapes of Wrath.
No, I like, because the actual documentary hit me that way, too, and I saw it first. So then I sit down in this giant theater, and they start playing me the Dust Bowl, and I'm like, Nolan, you son of a bitch. Don't do that to me, man. Don't do that. I can't take it.
People around you must have been so confused.
Yes.
Like, wait, what's happening? It's like, are you all right?
Yeah.
Do you need to leave?
It's like my other Pixar's Up. You know, where
right,
the beginning
right.
is just a gut
Jesus,
ripper.
Yeah.
But like, it was only for me with Interstellar. Everyone else was like, well, this is a boring start to a movie. And I was like, the Dust Bowl was so hard.
I'm with you.
It's so hard.
Alex, I'm with
it
you.
It is. Yeah. And it's an amazing doc because most of his other ones, either it's the Civil War and everything's old, or it's World War II and you're just seeing footage of it. But the Dust Bowl is kind of this in between where it is these photos and these letters and these archival things, but then you're seeing the actual people talk about, like, yeah, I was a tiny child blown away by a wave of dust trying to go to school, you know, that kind of thing. It's incredible.
Yeah. I wonder if Nolan's decision to make the sport that is played twice in the movie, baseball, was a nod to Ken Burns because of his
that
baseball doc, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Could be a Field of Dreams thing, too.
Yeah, it could be.
Or it could just be that it's like, it's America.
It's America.
Yeah. America.
It's like, have you had this apple pie? No, we only have
one. And it's the best sport to do that reveal he does, where John Lithgow is like, oh, who are these bums? And then they reveal the Yankees logo.
Yeah.
If you know anything about sports and baseball, the Yankees being a bunch of bums who are broke
right.
is the it's biggest
like a
reversal of American fortunes.
The other thing that I thought was interesting, which is the sequel to 2001, 2010, Lithgow's in. And he actually has a line where he's like, give me some hot dogs. Instead, like, so
what?
I think that line is actually
no
where
way.
Like, popcorn at
it's
baseball.
Deep cut reference. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was real weird. I
that's incredible.
I'm a nerd, so.
Yeah, there's a lot of deliberate references to 2001, but to do one that's a reference to
the sequel
nobody cares about is very bold. For all the effects in the film, Nolan deliberately had a mission statement, basically, where he was like, I don't want to waste any time thinking about futurism. Which means he didn't want to waste any time trying to design, oh, what do future clothes look like? What do future cars look like? He didn't want to spend any time on that. He was just like, let's just have it look basically the way that things look now. For two reasons. One, it allows the film a certain level of timelessness. Obviously, as time goes on, things will be dated, but it allows it to not kind of like immediately date itself, because that's one of the funny things about movies you watch supposed to be in the future. They're like, everybody's wearing the same neon colored trash bag. You're like, well, that didn't happen. So he did that for that reason. And then for another reason, he wanted to spend that energy, that amount of production time that would be spent trying to design this future world on the sorts of quote-unquote tricks that they were going to use to pull the movie off, because he didn't want to do just all CG. He was pretty adamant in a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff where he's like, we've seen everything I'm paraphrasing, but he says, we've seen everything from CG. Like, we're no longer amazed by what CG can do because we're so used to it now. So he's like, I don't want to do that. I want to just add it to the bag of tricks that we have normally, right. You know, like miniatures, full-size models, in-camera tricks, like perspective tricks. He just
it's
wants
just
that
a
to
tool.
Be. It's another tool that you use when it's most appropriate, which is so cool. And then that segues into how much of this goddamn movie is in-camera effects. It's insane how much is. Like, for instance, the robots. The robots are mostly... they're a pretty good mix, but mostly puppet work. Meaning it's this gigantic, you can see this on the behind the scenes DVD. It's this full size, what the size of the robots are in the movie, which it's 6 or 7 feet tall, it looks like.
Right.
Yeah.
And the actor that's doing the voice for the robot is behind that robot.
Bill Irwin, right?
Bill Irwin, yeah.
Yeah, who's actually, like, if you Google his name right now, you recognize this man. He's an actor. But he was CG'd out. But he's the puppet operator and one of the voices. I think Tars?
Yes. He operated both robots, but they got a different actor to do the voice for Case.
Case, yeah.
So it's him walking this robot for the scenes where it's walking. Like, he has an apparatus attached to his chest to keep it from tipping over, and then he's got another one attached to his leg so he can manipulate the robot as he's walking. And it's a heavy robot because they wanted it to look stainless steel. So
that's
the
so
puppet's
cool.
like 200 pounds, and he's sitting there muscling this thing along for those shots. So, like...
And watch the behind the scenes. I really, like, it's amazing because right before take, like, he, like, psychs himself out. Like, he's really dipping into it. Like, he has a certain gait. He has a certain, like intensity. Like, Bill Irwin, the actor, is really going for it to, like, make these puppets feel like they have, like, a soul.
Like, they move differently.
Yeah,
you know,
they move.
Watch Tars and Case. They sort of carry themselves differently.
Yeah, it's so great.
It's amazing.
It's also, I like the idea that this is a movie made just by muscle men. Like, Hoyt Van Hoytema is lifting this massive camera to watch Bill Irwin move a 500-pound puppet.
He's lurching his puppet along, And, I mean, for the scenes where, like, the robots unfold to, like, manipulate stuff, that's CG. But when they're already in that form, that's not. Like, for instance, when Brand is trapped on the water planet and Case turns into a wheel to go get her, the transformation is CG, but the wheel itself is real. It's they built it, and it's attached to, like, the side of an ATV, which they then removed with CG, and they're just driving this wheel
through
the water.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's amazingly...
Right, yeah. It's
like,
so good.
In camera.
And then they built a robot that had arms out so that it could carry Brand, who is, I believe, a stunt woman in that shot, but so that they could have an actual in-camera robot that's carrying her. And that scene, which this blew me right away, that water planet is a real location.
Right.
In Iceland?
Yeah, it's Iceland.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's a very shallow, like, sandbar.
And it's like, I mean, they add in, you know, the wave in the background, but there is a point where you can turn a certain direction and it's just nothing but water all the way to the horizon. So it looks like an ocean, but it's only a foot deep.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've been to Iceland in life, and there was one place we went that was a glacier area, and they said, oh, one movie that was shot here, along with some, like, James Bond movie skiing stuff, they did some interstellar stuff here. And I said, oh, yeah, it's probably that ice planet where he fights Matt Damon.
Yeah, Man's Ice Planet is that glacier, and they use the same glacier in Batman Begins.
Oh, great.
Which is why Nolan and his team knew to go there. Like, well, we can film this stuff there. Yeah. But yeah, we mentioned that they built life-size spacecrafts.
Yeah.
So that had, like, working landing gear that would extend and opening doors and stuff like that so that the actors could come in and out. And they do some of that. Like, Man's compound are sets that they built on the glacier, and it has, like, a working door that they kept having to shovel ice around because anything that's, you know, warmer than freezing starts to melt the ice. So, like, between takes, they'd have to, like, move the ice back around. And they had to reset things up every day because the glacier shifts.
Oh, wow.
So they're talking about, you know, if we bolted something down overnight, the glacier would shift 3 to 4 inches. So they'd come back the next day and the bolts are just out because the ground separated.
Right. While they're in Iceland, Anne Hathaway almost suffered hypothermia. Because the dry suit she was wearing had not been properly, like, prepared
or
secured. So it's like you're against the elements in this movie. Also, to make a movie about being against the elements, you're against the elements, you know?
Yeah.
Man.
It's in the water scene when she gets trapped under the rig.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, there's a hole in my suit.
Yeah, I'm now very cold.
Yeah, I am now very, very cold because they are in Iceland, standing in water.
Yeah, Iceland is not warm.
And for the scene where on the same planet where Doyle, played by Wes Bentley, drowns, he gets yanked away from the shuttle. That's the actor on a wire, and the wire's attached to a truck, and they just yank him and spray water. Like they tested it before with stuntmen, and then they just pulled the actor.
Nolan seems to love that stuff.
Every movie wants to flip
a truck or yank somebody across a field. It's his favorite thing.
It's great.
Well, speaking of which, from the work they had done on Inception, you know, because they have that zero-G sequence in the hotel, like they used a lot of what they learned making that movie to make the zero-G stuff in here. They didn't do a single, you know, like in Apollo 13, they did the vomit comet for those scenes.
Right.
Which is the plane that goes up and then dives for a couple, so you get a couple of seconds of weightlessness, and that's how they filmed the weightless scenes in Apollo 13.
In fact, it was the same production company, which we mentioned last
New
week.
New Deal, right?
No, it's Double Negative.
Double Negative, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
I wish it was named like Throw Up Airlines or so. Some
it's just like crazy shit happening.
Yeah.
.com.
They built so many cool things. The way that they did the weightlessness was it's 90% wires, and then the other 10% is this weird, almost a gimbal. It's like a crane that they would attach to the actors' waists, and then it's on an arm so they could raise and lower and then also move along a track for certain shots. But most of it's wire work, and the way they accomplished that was by they built a lot of the sets vertically, and then you just shoot it horizontally so it looks like they're moving, you know, from left to right or right to left, but in actuality they're in a gigantic set going up and down. And that's so that way you don't get that obvious pull of weight in that direction.
Oh.
So it completes the illusion that they're floating. They had an interesting bit with McConaughey and also with Wes Bentley talking about doing those scenes where you as the actor, because of the way the wires are actually pulling you, you have to keep your arms and legs in the air, which is a core workout. Like, people go to the gym to do that. So they had to do these long scenes where, like, you know, McConaughey's talking about, you know, like when you're in zero G's, your feet are going to float up. But we're in a situation where if we relax, our legs are going to drop down, and that won't happen. So it's like you have to just constantly keep your arms and legs like above so it looks like you're floating. So it's just this intense core workout.
I love that small touch when Anne Hathaway gets knocked out and her arms just raises, because that's what would happen in zero G.
Yeah, that was a really well done shot. It's when they're spinning so they can reattach to the endurance, and then it cuts to...
She blacks out for a bit or something.
Yeah, yeah. You see Bran just kind of nod out, and then her arm goes up, and that's the signifier that she's no longer conscious.
Every director is on, like, they have 350 people working under them, and they have collaborators in terms of, like, who is telling me, you know, creatively what happens. He didn't just think this up. He actually got two women, Marsha Ivins and Tony Myers, who were astronauts.
She gave the actors videos and such of what astronauts look like as they move around.
And like how to use IMAX cameras in enclosed spaces in spacecraft interior.
The thing that most blew me away is that the Tesseract in the end of the movie, which is the fifth dimension that McConaughey falls into, and which is just endless Murph rooms.
Yeah, bookshelves on bookshelves.
And strings.
That's a set. They built that.
No, it's not.
Oh,
cut it out.
The main area.
Hey, cut it out.
The main area is a set.
No, turn everything off.
But they also use projection light emitters, essentially, that would...
apparently, there's a few shots in that scene that are lit only by the projectors.
Yeah.
But yeah, they built that main area is a set. Like that, you can see it in the behind the scenes features, but there's like Murph's bed suspended in the air and then a lamp suspended in the air. So that they had a physical space for McConaughey, who's on wires, to move around and interact with. And, you know, they have the strings. They use CG, obviously, to extend the images and make it look like this endless thing. But they built that flipping set.
Yeah.
And it's huge. They built it vertically like they did with, you know, the spaceship sets.
Murph.
It's crazy.
And it's a
I never would have thought that was a set. I just assumed McConaughey was on wires in front of a green screen.
Yeah, you just don't know another way to do it. Like, that's a spot where you'd be accepting of CGI, because how would you not do it that way?
Apparently, a big reason why was Nolan was saying, I think Nolan, somebody in the behind-the-scenes material for this film was saying that it was necessary for the performance because in the script, that sequence is so abstract. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty abstract in the movie, too. When you get to that sequence, you're like, it's the most challenging section of the film. Really, what is happening? And on paper, it's even more so. So by building the set, you know, to show what it was and how, you know, what it was going to be, that, you know, McConaughey shows up. He's like, oh, I understand what this is now. And I know how to play this now.
Yeah, like, I'm not Sir Ian McKellen in Lord
right,
of the Rings.
Right, yeah. So if it was just him hanging in a green screen space, he's just like, all right, now imagine it's looking like this.
A moat.
Yeah.
On two other short details that I thought were also in this, like, in-camera shit, is the giant dust clouds. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, when they had to chase them away from the baseball game.
Not CG. They use large fans to blow a cellulose-based synthetic dust into the air.
That seems dangerous.
Yeah, but they did it. And then the other thing is...
It sounds like the actual Dust Bowl.
Here's my favorite thing, because it's like Christopher Nolan, who's like a filmmaker, but he's like secretly in the corn business, and I'll tell you why. So Christopher Nolan produced Man of Steel, so he knew that this type of thing was feasible. And what I mean by type of thing is that he grew, for the film, 500 acres of corn, and then they sold the corn and made a profit.
Sweet.
What? So just like
delicious corn. Like,
how do we make money? Well, we make a movie and then we sell the corn.
We make a movie. We set it in a cornfield. We grow a shitload of corn. Then we flip that.
Flip it for real, baby.
I like that he's so into practical effects. He has to make his own corn.
Grow a flipping cornfield. There's one more quick thing I wanted to mention.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
In Iceland, on the glacier, they were. Periods where they would be getting hit with 100-mile-an-hour winds.
Oh, yeah.
So they just couldn't film anymore. So they had to go back to the hotel. And Nolan's the type of guy, I imagine any director would be on a film of this size, where it's like, you're losing a day. You can't. That's a lot of money and time.
Right. You're full of rage about it, probably.
Right, yes. You want to just choke the world to death. So he had, rather than just have a wasted day, when they went back to the hotel, he got the crew and McConaughey and Matt Damon out in the parking lot and shot inserts of them in the parking lot of the hotel.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of them traversing the planet. Like, some of those inserts were filmed in the hotel parking lot because he didn't want to lose his day, man.
Yeah. And also don't want people to die.
Yeah.
So then they like redid the background? Wouldn't there just be like parking lane lines
and stuff? Yeah. No, they like at a certain line in the horizon, they just throw up a green screen.
But the parking lot itself was just like rock and gravel and stuff. Right. So it worked for what they were doing.
They can just shovel it in for the shot. Yeah. So let's talk about post-production. The film contains 850 visual effect shots, most of which are in IMAX. What's crazy to me is that Kip Thorne would provide pages of like super sourced like equations to create accurate computer simulations of like gravitational lensing, like everything we see with the black hole, and just this phenomena that we witness, you know, our astronomers, you know, witness. So that made it so that like when they went into the After Effects, so when they went into the 3D modeling of these things and like the what does light do? What does dust do? And all that stuff. The visual effects artist, some individual frames took up to 100 hours to render. And the whole thing totaled 800 terabytes of data.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of Napster
and
songs.
What's really cool is, as we were talking about earlier, about how we all love science here at the podcast, the visual effect provided Thorne with new insight into the effects of gravitational lensing and how accretion disks, which are like just how like the dust settles when things are being pulled in or being pushed out of black holes, led to he made a publication, three scientific papers, because he worked on this film.
Wait, and so they took his theories and then they visualized them
for
the movie.
And then he was like, oh.
And then based on the visualization of it, he was like,
he wrote more papers.
I have some new ideas. And then he published scientific papers.
So science came out of this movie.
This movie is the best.
Yes.
It's the best movie.
That's awesome.
We talked about how the movie was made. Now let's get into some observations in a segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit.
Secret things.
first one I want to point out is really kind of the only point of the movie where I was like, that's a little on the nose. But Matt Damon's character, Dr. Mann, is the only real villainous character we get in the movie, unless you want to count Michael Caine, but even then, that's like, not really. Mann, as he is sweatily named, is meant to represent man or humanity. And he's the evil that earlier when Brandon Cooper are talking about nature and they land on, you know, nature isn't evil. It's only what we bring with us into it. It'll only be what we bring with us into space. And man is that evil. He's cowardly and he's just concerned with himself. And they keep talking about he's the best of us. And he winds up being, you know, at least the worst parts of humanity are what he winds up representing.
He's very prideful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he does everything because he thinks, I did so much work, I ought to get this. But nature doesn't have that. You know,
correct. Yeah. Nature is not, it's never anything but impartial.
Yeah.
And that's repeated throughout the film.
And he can't deal with that. But Coop can.
Yes.
Even though he does, like, when they're on that cliffside, like, he says, like, you're thinking about your children and, like, that's your problem, basically. And he's like, no, that's kind of why I'm here.
Right. That's part of why I don't lose my humanity right now.
Yeah. So Coop's the true bastion of humanity in this sequence.
There's also string theory is represented in this movie, which is a very dense thing that I barely understand, but it's visually represented in the Tesseract sequence because we see that everything object in the room is on a string, and that's how Coop is able to manipulate it as he kind of plucks these strings. Yeah. And I'll do my best to give like a layman description of it, but string theory is a theory of quantum gravity. Basically, it's the idea that particles are strings that carry gravitational force across time and space. So it's like this theory that...
This movie rules. It's the best. They put this in a movie.
Yeah. So it's basically a unified theory of gravity and particle physics, which makes... Basically, it's a potential theory of everything, or a master theory, basically, which is a hypothetical theory physics.
M theory? Is that the is that what the M stands for?
I think so.
Okay.
It's basically a hypothetical theory about physics that explains all physical aspects of the universe. So they represent that in this movie and it's a repeated motif of gravity can cross anything. It can cross every dimension. And that string theory is a way of visualizing that. It's like everything is a string, and that's how gravity travels across all dimensions.
Right.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really cool.
I love that it's all wrapped up in like this idea that there's a fifth dimension, right? And so you got like quarks and you got light, all the, you know, normal atoms and matter and stuff. And then you got love.
You got love.
Love is the fifth dimension.
Did we agree that as a scientist that time is the fourth dimension? I can't remember.
Time is fourth dimension.
Time is fourth dimension.
You got XYZ time.
There's lots of repeated imagery in the film.
Yeah, there's a lot of like iteration or like kind of like a computer program. Like it's not necessarily aggressive, but it's just like steady operation of a simple thing, which is kind of what science is. It's just like, let's keep searching.
For instance, the shot of the shuttle swinging around the wormhole is very, very similar to the shot of the shuttle going through man's planet.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of like curving around this object. The stand is a book that's repeatedly visible on Merce's bookshelf. Apparently the books are all carry some significance.
They all were things, books that Nolan read in order to make the movie.
But like the stand is specifically about a plague that wipes out humanity and then people trying to come together. And then you see the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle book in there, and one of the characters' name is Doyle.
Wes Bentley, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Another symbolism that I liked is the, first off, the shape of the space station, which is like a clock face. Time being a major theme in the movie. Also, the fact that, also in Man and Steel, Superman appears in Saturn is like the same place where the wormhole is. And it's also where they create Cooper's station, right? And Saturn.
That's where the wormhole was, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Saturn is a myth. Saturn has a myth if you look back to like what Saturn, the Roman god, connected to growth and agriculture. Not only is he connected to crops, but he's also known as Kronos, which is the god of time and cycles. So time is a theme. Oh. The appearance of the wormhole next to a planet is highly significant because of agriculture and corn. Like, it's all, it's perfect.
It's pretty dope.
And one thing I keep coming back to with this movie is the amount I like it. I think indicates that I'm strange, because like it's not because it's not a good movie, but going into it, I'm like, oh man, you got string theory, you got Greek mythology, you got corn.
You
like,
got
I'm excited
books.
For all of it. You know,
you
what
have
I mean?
Lots of corn.
It just all the notches.
We got books.
Yeah,
we mentioned earlier there's a lot of 2001 symbolism in this movie. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff I spotted was the robots all look like the monolith from 2001. They're also the most dependable, stalwart members of the crew. Like, the robots are unwavering. They never falter, which is an inverse of what happens with HAL 9000 in 2001.
Right. Turn down your humor setting.
Yeah, HAL goes nuts in 2001, where these robots chill the whole time. Yeah.
I also love the lines from Case. It's not possible during the docking sequence, and Cooper says, no, it's necessary. How awesome that is, and how we all remember it, and there's Hans Zimmer going on, you know, like...
Yeah, playing his organ.
It's a reference to a famous quote during the Apollo 13 NASA mission, where one of the... I assume it's Tom Hanks, but one of the astronauts says, failure is not an option. Mm. And it's like, so it's like a famous, like, no, I'm going to survive. I got to do it. And so that was... Nolan has kind of come out and said, like, that was the... You know, relevance for that line.
Obviously, McConaughey, Cooper falling through the black hole, and then like what happens to him as he transcends space and time is very similar to the end of 2001.
Space baby.
Space baby.
I mean, Coop is a space baby.
And this made me laugh out loud when I saw the movie in the theater, but the explanation of wormholes that Rom gives to Coop is the same way Sam Neill explains them in Event Horizon.
Event Horizon, yeah.
The
just
exact
like,
same
yeah,
way.
Yeah, just take a pencil
and,
and
then pokes
the
it and folds the paper and then pokes it. Pokes the pencil
at this
the
point
paper.
I think it's safe to say that like the majority of America and probably the world, like, this is how they would explain if you were like, explain to me wormholes.
It's a fantastic explanation. And of course Rom takes it a step further and explains why it looks like why it's a sphere,
right,
which was
neat. Right,
but the basic explanation is there. The other big observation I wanted to make is, in my opinion, or like what I took away from this movie, is I think this is the closest Christopher Nolan has come to making a movie that is about faith. And not necessarily in a religious sense, but part of that, faith and spiritualism.
Yeah, it's a spiritual...
Because we mentioned earlier, the score is church music. It's organ-driven.
That's true.
The movie is about making leaps of faith. Mm-hmm. You know, love leading you through an impartial universe that's neither inherently good or evil. Like, every decision Cooper and Brand make that's based on logic turns out to be the wrong one. Like, they go to Miller's planet, and it's a fucking disaster. Then Doyle gets killed, and then they lose 22 or 23 years, however much time it is. They have that argument about whether they should go to Edmund's planet or Man's planet. Edmund's is the emotional decision that Brand wants to make, but Man's is the logical decision. And then that turns out to be wrong, because Man was lying.
Yeah. It's interesting because we were talking about how love is like the fifth dimension, though. It's like, as you just put it, this movie is really about how emotions have like gravity, right? They pull things in much like gravity does to matter itself. And it's like this emotional quality that Nolan doesn't do in any of his other movies.
Right, yeah. It's not a factor in any of his other films.
I guess that's the Murphy's Law, though. Anything that can't happen. So Nolan making an emotional movie.
Yeah, that is, logic is such a... I think my favorite thing about this movie is that it's so much about logic not being enough and logic not being the only thing we can lean on. And
right.
That you need to have love, too, in order to function. Because I think Man is not the only villainous character, but I think he's the clearest example in it of someone who has decided just to operate on logic, losing their humanity and becoming evil. You know, I think the idea is that we're all evil if we give that up, and he's the one who gives it up the most.
Right. Like, we can't dismiss emotion as a legitimate tool in making decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're right. Every decision where it's not present is kind of wrong and evil.
And it's also a movie about science in a way that I love, because I think there's a lot of movies where it's that Michael Crichton viewpoint where science just becomes evil no matter what, and that's very boring to me. And there's also a lot of movies where science is just like a superhero power, like Iron Man, and that's very boring to me too.
Yeah.
This is a movie where science is a challenge. Science is a thing
struggle
that you just need to take on, and it's not good or evil. Like, it's just an element of the overall trying to survive.
It's observation.
Yeah, yeah, and that connects back to the idea that nature's neither good or evil, because science is just a way of observing nature.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Because all the other Touchstone movies for this movie, especially 2001, they tend to have evil robots. And this movie, the robots are just awesome because they built them to be awesome and great.
There's a lot more magic in 2001. there's some magic in this movie too, but like 2000.
There is, yeah. This one, it's like a neat marriage of that 2001 borderline magical space journey and that Apollo 13 or gravity, like race against time space journey. It's both of them at once in such a cool way.
You know, what's crazy is that George R. R. Martin actually said of this film, when he watched it, he was like, this is the most like ambitious and since 2001.
Yeah.
So I believe that. Yeah. It's definitely the densest.
Yeah. Says the most ambitious and challenging science fiction film since Kubrick's 2001. George R. R. Martin.
There's one more point I wanted to make, and it's that the line. I mean, obviously, the movie begins with Merv saying, "I thought you were the ghost."
You were a ghost.
That's a repeated motif, and when McConaughey tells her, he figured out that when you become a parent, you learn that we're here to be ghosts for our children. That's the film's thesis, ultimately, I think.
Right.
It's that memory and love and inspiration are as powerful. They're powerful, but scientifically unquantifiable forces because they push us forward. They make us do things. And then Professor Brand's line where he says, Michael Caine character, he says, I'm not afraid of death. I'm afraid of time, is echoing that as well, because he's not worried about not existing anymore. He's worried about that he's missing his chance to become that ghost.
Right.
His children, both Dr. Brand, who is literally his daughter, and then everyone else, all the humanity he's leaving behind, won't be able to use his quote unquote ghost,
which is the
propel them forward.
Which is the point of Michael Caine says in the film, "Do not go gentle into that good night," which is a quote of a Dylan Thomas poem.
Mm-hmm.
And that poem, Dylan Thomas actually like wrote while his dad was dying. At the end of the poem, Thomas encourages his father to do the same and fight and protest his death. That's what the poem's about, because it's like in the poem, life is symbolized by light and death is symbolized by the night and darkness. Yeah. And it refers to all kinds of men, wise men, good men, wild men, grave men. And they do not achieve all the things that they wanted to in their life. And as a result, they all rage against the dying of the light and resist their deaths.
Cool.
That is exactly that's also what the film's about, is that Dylan Thomas poem.
Mm-hmm.
That time symbol you guys pointed out is really interesting to me, too, because you see there's so many, especially seeing it in a theater on a big screen, shots of Gargantua just being this all-encompassing thing, and then there's that little wheel of the spaceship just trickling along in front of it, and it looks like there's Buddhist symbols I've seen where there's like that wheel of time. It's just like struggling against this evil. Also, Gargantua looks like an anti-Saturn to me. Like, kind of has rings around it. It's like
fire,
evil
accretion discs,
evil nightmare Saturn. You know?
Metal-ass fire around it.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, the way that Coop gives Murph the world-saving equation is through a watch.
Yeah, time.
Yeah.
Time.
It explodes.
Movie's about time. We solved it here. At Cracked.
All right. Bonus scenes that should have existed.
I want to see the scene where the dwellers on Cooper Station get livid about how their windows are broken anytime a baseball game is played.
Yeah, that definitely seems like it would be a problem.
Yeah.
There's one, it is not truly a wish because I think it would ruin the emotion of it, but Rom is waiting for Coop and Brand on the Wave Planet for 23 years, and I really want to see the hijinks of the...
Right.
Like, if you've ever seen the movie Rocket Man with Harlan Williams, where he's just kind of on a spaceship by himself, and Disney does a bunch of bits with it, you know?
Right.
I just want to see the bits. I want to see the crazy things he gets up to, with, like, dressing
bits.
In blankets and making a lady out of stuff, and, you know, that kind of thing.
It would be funny if it was just him quietly doing equations for years.
He's just that boring.
Yeah. Just like... I want to see the story where he like one day runs out of pencils, you know, like just that he doesn't have anything to
do. Yeah,
like
the Twilight Zone episode where Burgess Meredith's glasses break. He can't read books.
No!
One last question I wanted to ask, and Abe has an answer for this, which I'm grateful. I could have looked this up on my own, but I didn't, so we're going to find the answer in real time here. Where'd they get the beer that they're drinking? It's like John Lithgow and Matthew McConaughey are chilling with some beer, and then he's, you know, but like all the crops are dead but corn.
It's corn beer.
Corn beer exists.
It exists. Corn it's beer. Called millet beer, and it's very common in Africa. They don't have it in the States that often. I saw it in Mexico is where I drank it.
Yeah. Every meal in that movie is distractingly corn-based.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's delightful when she goes to eat dinner at Casey Affleck's house. And it's just 9 different corn dishes.
Yeah. And the mom's like, eat your fritter to, like, hammer it home. Like, just all diets or 9 kinds of corn.
It's that Rick and Morty joke where it's like, would you like a pill? Who wants pill brulee for dessert? Or they're just eating pills.
Yeah, I like the idea
all different configurations.
Someone who's not aware of, like, what's going on globally is just, like, inserted into the movie. And it was like, oh, good, dessert. Is it more corn? You know, like, it just seems like.
It's corn.
They're all like,
with
yeah.
With corn frosting.
We're super tired of this observation. We all know we fucking eat corn all the time. We all hate it. We want it to be better. But it's our ancestors' fault.
It's like that thing where there's a trope where Brad Pitt in movies will often be eating. Just his character will be
eating. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just a bit of business he does.
I want him to be in the movie just eating corn products in every scene.
So we talked about how the movie's made and how some things were problematic. We like to talk about whether or not this movie should go on the gold record we send into space. Big question is, do we show this movie to aliens?
Obviously, yes, right? If ever there was a movie to go on a gold record, which is, you know, it's a phrase we use, but it's like Carl Sagan.
It's Voyager 1.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously this movie's connections to Contact, which is a Carl Sagan novel. So if ever we were going to put a movie onto a gold record and it's not Contact, it should probably be this one, right?
It would be an insult to Gold Space Records if we didn't put this on gold record.
Overwhelmingly, yes. Which is the first time in this podcast we've got three
yeses,
of the same...
Yeah. This is
in agreement. This is
not. I think it shows the best parts of humanity.
Yeah, it shows like this little grassroots upstart known as humans can transcend matter into energy and persevere against the darkness. We're badasses and worthy of knowing.
Yeah. If nothing else, if you want the logic of how do we intimidate the aliens into not invading, it's like we got love, we got logic, we got space magic.
Yeah.
Back off.
Yeah, we can defeat you with a paradox,
motherfucker. We can talk through books. well. Now this has turned into a boring segment. So commenters, please tell us if there's a reason not to show this movie to aliens.
You won't find one.
Yeah, the way we'd use this movie to threaten aliens is much the same way that, like, time travel works in Bill and Ted. Because I just briefly mentioned that this movie is a time paradox, because the only reason any of the events happen is because we make them happen in the future as human beings. So it's like, it's a Bill and Ted version of space travel.
Right.
When I think a lot of people bump on the contradictions that are just straight up in the how the story works, and I don't mind them. It's a piece of art that expresses what's trying to do
right
perfectly to me, and it's great.
I feel like it's not distracting in this film.
Yeah.
Oh, we're all so in love with this film. It's so clear. There's someone listening to the podcast. They're like, it was fine.
We'll put one up on the board. Yet another dead wife for Christopher Nolan.
Yep, in it. Yet another dead wife.
McConaughey's
That's
wife,
true.
Super dead.
Yeah,
super dead wife.
I think the only movie where he doesn't have dead wives are the Martha Wayne's. It's super dead.
It's not his wife.
They gave him that.
Mom.
Though, yeah.
Well, I mean, and then his would-be wife explodes in the second movie.
Let's know if you guys have any theories about Nolan's weird female psychology.
Well, because I've also heard this movie criticized for Anne Hathaway being the one, when they're debating whether to go to Man's Planet or Edmund's Planet, being the one who's like, well, I'm in love with Edmund's, you know? But I think they couch that in McConaughey being super in love with his family.
And she turns out to be right.
She's right.
And she's right. And she relents. Like, she's not so crazy emotional,
right,
let's say, about it, that she demands they go there. She goes along with it. I think it's fine, but maybe that's my privilege, you know? Like, maybe it is something that is more Nolan not writing women well.
Well, I'm going to ask you to check that.
If you could, please check your privilege.
Check your privilege.
Privilege.
What did I say?
I don't know.
Privilege.
It's a word that doesn't exist.
I'm so bad at words.
I'm going to turn my bunganin.
Why am I on podcasts? I shouldn't be. So we're done here, but we want to talk about how you can talk to us. So check us out on Twitter and Instagram at @crackedmoviepod. On Facebook, we're at facebook.com/crackedmoviepod. Or just, you know, search Cracked Movie Club. Hit us up with your thoughts. We've been Abe, Tom, and Alex. Alex, where can we find you online, or what do you want to say right now?
Oh, man. I'm very grateful to be on our site so much and check out all our podcasts. And my personal website is alexschmitty.com. But mainly look at Cracked stuff. It's just great. And particularly follow this podcast, you geniuses who know about Mobiuses and World War II submarines and many other things I don't understand. Good job.
Yeah, well, I also subscribe to your newsletter, which is amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Your internet newsletter.
That's on the website.
I'm excited because I, you know, admittedly can barely grasp string theory, so I'm excited for one of our listeners is going
to... Yeah, astrophysicist is going to be like, they fucked up so bad and I need to tell them. And I'm eager to hear all those words.
I know I did. It's so dense. I was just like... But still, it's an... I await.
You await the incoming deluge.
Of instruction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that's what we're here about. We're scientists here. We're movie scientists. Well, Alex, we've been honored that you joined us. Next week, we're going to be talking about another Nolan, The Dark Knight Trilogy. We're going to take three movies.
Three Nolans.
I don't know what we're going to do with that.
Oh, it's going to be a lot. It's going to be like a 14-hour episode.
Yeah, it's like 6 hours... All compacted into an hour.
I mean, the Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises together are 6 hours.
My hope is that we'll just like the cream will rise to the top. Is that the phrase? What is it? What rises to the top?
The corn rises to the top. And then
we'll only tell you the most interesting things and you can, you know, walk away from it. And that's going to be our last Nolan film for the month. 5 weeks. That will be the end.
That's how the calendar works. Power of time.
Yeah, power of time. Passage of time. The endurance. Power of love. Of time. So, commenters, we're open to films and directors you think we should talk about, so let us know. We read and listen to all that, so send us your thoughts. That's it. Watch on, movie people.
Hey, everybody, I'm Brandon Johnson.
And I'm Robert Evans.
And we are the hosts of Cracked Gets Personal, which is a show where we talk to a wide variety of people about a wide variety of topics.
We're talking garbage men.
Outside of the dumpster, it was a suitcase, and inside the suitcase was 24 porn DVDs. And there's a couple beer cans also in. And I'm like, that guy must have had a good night.
Former human slaves.
He made money off of me from turning tricks. He made money off of me from the pornography. But, like, I had to sign the contract, because if I didn't, he would beat me.
The whole gamut of human experiences, we have juiced it like a delicious orange and mixed it with the tequila of comedy in order to make a tequila sunrise of knowledge and laughter.
Make sure to be around on August 16th, because that's when the first two episodes are going to drop. And please, please, click and subscribe.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.